This is Screen Divers. On this episode of Screen Divers, we are talking about immortal classic 1992, Glengarry Glen Ross, directed by James Foley, based on a stage play by David Mamet, screenplay by David Mamet, based on a stage play by David Mamet, produced by Jerry Tarkowski, and starring a golden cast of fine actors: Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Alec Baldwin, Ed Harris, Alan Arkin, Kevin Spacey, and Jonathan Pryce. Phenomenal cinematography by Juan Ruiz Antilla, and edited by Howard Smith. Music by James Newton Howard. This movie has a running time of 100 minutes. It was made for $12.5 million, and it didn't make much money on release. It made $10.7 million American dollars. How are you, Ricky?
I'm all right. How are you?
How are you, Steve?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. How are you, Dave?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad, sir. On this episode, we have a very special guest. We have a daily colorist artist. His name is David Joshua Smith. Thank you for being with us today, Dave. It's 6 a.m. in New York, isn't it?
I appreciate the invite.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Dave.
I work in post-production. I do dailies. I'm a colorist by trade, but right now I'm kind of falling into a trap of doing dailies on TV shows, working on a bunch of stuff. I did the dailies on Penguin for HBO. Currently working on Elspeth and season 3 of Diplomat.
Very nice. Oh. Excellent shows, man. But do you want to tell the guys here how we know each other, Dave?
We know each other through Horror Weekly.
George. Ah, George. The smooth sound of your voice, George. He knows it. He knows it. Ricky, what's this movie about?
We are in a nondescript eastern location of America for about 24 hours where shit people are shit at their jobs and they shit all over each other.
They definitely do
that's
shit
pretty much it, man.
Fair description.
Oh my god. Man, for this episode, guys, I have a plethora of factoids for you. Loads.
I bet you do.
Oh yeah. Should we talk about one of them right away? Because I'm just...
Well, yeah, I was just going to mention that you forgot Jonathan Pryce's actual title, which is Sir Jonathan Pryce.
Oh my god, okay,
yeah,
whatever.
There you go. There's a little factoid straight up.
I thought you were going to say shithead.
Excellent. Holy shit, mate.
Jonathan Shithead Price.
What the fuck?
I've got to talk to my wife. I've got to talk to my wife. No, my wife said I can't talk to you. No, I can't. I just can't. No.
I'm not gay.
Queer. Who cares if you're queer?
We got to talk about that because, man, these guys, the dynamic among, like, the way that they're written. And obviously, the play was much shorter. So the movie, actually, this movie is a classic for a reason. I think the screenplay actually fleshed out these characters even more.
Oh yeah.
And the only one that has redeeming features and that I can relate to because I work in sales. All right, I'm not a salesman. I work in sales reluctantly because I'm good at it, but I don't have that predatory fucking instinct. It's the essence of douchebaggery. You need to be, and you see that in this movie. It's I mean, the working environment would be a field dream for any HR department these days, really. You know, it's not a toxic environment at all. Like,
I don't think Mr. Murray have an HR department.
We are going to be swearing in this episode, all right? In this episode, we're going to be swearing. Like, it's not that we normally do, but this movie apparently didn't want to be made by anybody because of the language in it.
That's fair.
I mean, we can go straight to the controversial lines if you want.
Oh,
you know, we can start talking about Patels. Is it Patel on this card? Does it say Patel on this card?
And most of it is delivered by someone called Ricky as well. So that's kind of Mr. Roma.
What's your experience with this movie, Umba? Come on, let's get...
You're
let's
asking me, we've got a fucking guest. You're asking me?
Yeah.
I'm asking
you.
You
normally go last.
I want to know.
Well, okay. All right. I picked this movie. So, but we collectively picked this movie. It's you know, it's amazing.
I had no choice.
Yeah, absolutely. You didn't have a choice. But that's this is enough democracy, dude. That's how it is, but yeah, whatever. I first watched it when I moved, because it's dialogue heavy, right? And in 1992, this would have been dubbed in Italian. Although, again, Italians are really, really good, just like the Spanish and the Germans are very good at dubbing. So, like we said in the previous episode, you would have actors that would spend their lifespan just dubbing one particular actor. So you kind of sync with that, you know, like there's a... It's, for example, Pacino is in this, and Pacino has had the same dubbing guy for forever in Italy.
And what's his name?
I don't know. But it is a thing. It's a, because obviously, you know, sometimes the experience that we have with dubbing mostly is like from years ago. If you ever downloaded something that wasn't available yet illegally, which we never do.
Never.
Yeah, you come across like a screener from Russia, and there's like a 20-second delay with the Russian guy going, Sputnik, whatever the fuck, on top. So it doesn't work.
Sorry. I know we were going to start talking about the racial insensitivity.
There's nothing
to see
about this movie, and we're not going to do that today. All right, we're getting cancelled. But cancelled from what? Like,
someone has to listen to us to cancel us, Umbar. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. We're just here to destroy Dave's career. It's fine.
It's happened before. I'll recover.
Happened before? Not like this, it didn't, Dave. Kevin, in the last episode, right after we recorded, 45 minutes later, he sent me a message going, can you send me the like a rough draft of the edit, please? I just want to listen to it. Is there something compromising we said? Or yeah, there was, but it didn't end up on the episode, Kevin. So going back to my experience, I think I didn't watch it in Italy because I didn't speak a single word of English in the 90s. So when I moved to Australia, I rented it. I rented it from Blockbuster. And again, Blockbuster, we should be sponsored by a company that doesn't exist anymore.
There's one Blockbuster left.
Yeah, you want to reach out to them? It's easier that way, right? We don't have to call a head office or anything. But yeah, it was, and I was sharing a house, watching it, and it blew my fucking mind. It absolutely blew my mind back then. And it was already at a time of my life in which I was praising dialogue like, as a quality I was seeking. Movies that were dialogue rich and dialogue heavy. First of all, it was a way for me to learn this language. And secondarily, I
hesitate to think of how well you learned English from this film.
not from this film, but in general, like movies were a way to... it was like active listening. So you would just sit down and just take things in. You know what I mean? So I think that was much more constructive at the beginning than jumping into a conversation and actively taking part in it. It was just more difficult. But not to mention the fact that I already had a love for movies, but in 1994, there were movies like Clerks, for example, coming out, which were not about anything visual. Like it was the dialogue-rich nature of it all that became appealing to me. You know, even Pulp Fiction, that came out in 92, around the same time this movie was released, was dialogue-rich. You know what I mean? Like it's... So... One thing though that I didn't notice back then was how toxic this movie is, you know. And I think by any standards, anything you see, some people still consider this movie to be a masterclass in sales, and it isn't. It's the exact opposite. I mean, everyone in this is the crooks. Yeah, the foundation of what should drive you perhaps is there, but every single message out of it's not that it's dated. It's just some people actually still apply this as a. And even if they are successful, I would never wish for the personality traits that this movie could instill in somebody to for them to absorb it. Like I would never wish for them to follow this as a guideline. It is terrifying, absolutely terrifying. Like ethics go out the window, and all of them are crooks, pretty much. Besides Alan Arkin's character, but we'll talk about him later. Steve, you asked the question. So, what's your experience with this movie?
I watched it back in 1994. I think again, Blockbuster situation. I really enjoyed it. I again, dialogue heavy, and we can see how people like Quentin Tarantino have watched this or seen the screenplay or anything like that and taken hints at how to construct dialogue off this. I tried to write. I'm useless. So
you can draw, though.
I can draw, and I can kind of write. Dialogue was always a problem for me. And watching something like this was, it's a masterclass in dialogue construction.
It is.
The first 5 minutes introduce every single one of the characters perfectly. And you can see straight away their major kind of attitudes towards each other straight away. And it's just a well-constructed play, but also a better constructed movie than the play itself.
It is, which is a rare occurrence.
Very rare for the
source material to be announced by another iteration of it that came after the source material.
But it's at least it's the same writer. That's what we're looking at.
There is one thing, though. I don't want to project something other than what I want to focus on for myself today as well. Like I said, that I really praise the dialogue. There is a quality that I didn't pick up on my first viewing. And perhaps, thank God that we live in an era, every once in a while there are gemstones when it comes down to restoring movies from a different era. And man, the remaster of this movie highlighted something for me. It's beautiful.
It is.
It's beautifully lit.
And I'm just going to, because we both had that same moment with the car and the lighting from red from the street, which is
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Dave, we should keep not skipping our guest, actually.
So, Dave.
What is, yeah, there you go.
Dave, what's your, what's your story with this?
I can tell you that when this film came out back in 92, I did not get a chance to see it in the theater, but I was aware of it. But I was already kind of a fan of David Mamet because of, you know, the stuff he had done with House of Games. One of my favorite movies growing up was The Untouchables, so I rewatched that.
Tell me you heard our episode on The Untouchables.
Of course I heard your episode.
Okay.
Fantastic.
So Mamet was always someone that was on my radar. I read a lot of Roger Ebert, and Roger Ebert, of course, you know, he effused over Mamet all the time. So I was aware of this, and I had a chance to, I think I was able to get a copy of the play before I saw the movie.
How old were you back then?
I was about 19 or 20.
That sucks, don't it?
Yeah, I know. It's a long time ago. But, you know, it was interesting to read the play. I've never seen it performed on stage, but I did read the play and saw the film when it came out on video. And, you know, it blew me away.
You live in New York, Dave.
I live in New York.
And Glengarry Glen Ross has gone on Broadway. If you don't get tickets, we will collectively pay for your tickets, man.
No, we won't.
We can't afford it.
No, we won't. No. Don't even say
Mickey,
that.
You said you were going to get him tickets, so please.
Don't even say that. Don't even need to. No,
I'm sorry about this. Dave.
Selling
this
promises, is Ricky. Selling all right? Promises. You're embarrassing all the time. Us, Ricky.
Dude, you know?
What are you trying to sell? What are you
actually? To be honest with you, this was Ricky's idea.
All those board games behind you.
Ricky's going to pay for it. Okay, I'm sorry, I spoke out of turn. Yeah. You were meant to know. All right.
Yeah.
There's a check in the mail. It's like fucking.
It's got
20 years ago.
Creatures all over that check.
In your house, in order for me to go see the play.
Ricky's going to print out like a folk ticket, like just a plane ticket, and send it to you in the mail.
It's going to say Glengarry Glen Ross, as brought to you by Jack Lemmon.
By the courtesy of the Screen Divers.
Now, have I got a sale for you? Now, is your wife on the phone? Fuck. I was talking to your wife.
Holy shit. And Ricky, now it is your time to tell us what your experience is. Plus,
this is going to be a little bit of a moment that normally somebody else has on the show, but I actually got to this film quite late. So I probably got to this film 10 to 12 years after its initial release. And so there are so many things about this film that watching it at that point is real. And watching it then and being like, oh, that's where they got it from. So, for example, is it Gil from The Simpsons? Is totally Jack Lemmon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And being able to see those connections. Yeah. Like, oh, geez, and all that stuff. But it didn't detract away from this film when I first watched it. And it became a housemate favorite when I was in London for about 4 or 5 years.
Mm. It is different in adulthood. It really hits differently. Like, it, particularly for me, like I said earlier, like it is a nightmare because you do meet certain, there are archetypes in this and you meet all of them in my field. You meet all of them and it's fucking terrifying. I don't know. It's been a while and watching this movie was actually enjoyable for a reason, but at the same time I was like, oh fuck. And I forgot about it. You know, you tend to choose workplaces where, I mean, the infrastructure available to people now in sales, usually, as toxic as it is, it's possibly the only field where you welcome, like, the interference of an HR department, if there's any, because it is brutal. It's absolutely brutal. There are targets, and you do meet people of all ages, all backgrounds, and the problem is their moral compass may be pointing in a completely different direction than yours, and it's fucking terrifying, you know. Like, there's a predatory quality to all the characters in this, and then there's an archetype within that as well. And I think the worst one, believe it or not, the worst of all is Richard Roma. It's Ricky.
Yeah.
When he's approached, because he sets it up by Link in the bar, it shows that this is at the end of the day. He always does this. But throughout this sequence, we see him sliding over closer and closer and closer. And then he pounces like an animal. Like, this is a fucking documentary, you know, like a predator. But it's the nuance in it. He's preying upon this guy's insecurities, but most of all, it is obviously picking up on some latent kind of homosexuality from him as well. And he dives right into it. There's a moment in which he kind of closes himself up to Jonathan Pryce's character. He almost goes under his armpit. You know what I mean? And then later on, this hits back when they're in the office and he keeps touching his hair. I don't know if you remember Al Pacino touching his hair, like doing like a head toss. It's nuanced and it's there and it's brutal. I was waiting for Pacino to go, wah, anytime, because that's, you know, you always expect it. But this was around the, you know, the time of Heat as well. I think
this was also a time when Pacino was
chipping coke. Yes.
Well,
hard.
He was kind of going back and forth between being, you know, serious actor Pacino and cinematic ham.
I thought I was going to do the canceling. You're doing it yourself, Dave. It's fine.
Go ahead. I mean, Glengarry, he's doing some incredible acting. So this is Pacino, you know, diving in and doing, like, you know, real shit.
Don't forget that, like, this was the same year that Centerfold Woman got released, which he did get the Oscar for.
Yeah.
So he was jumping from, like, this is probably the most serious role he had done since, I don't know, his choice of film is always down to, like, how much time he can sit in the character and feel the character out. There's so many actors that I read that kind of took the roles, turned down the roles for 5 years in making this film. One of them ended up being in the film and they wrote his part for him, which was Alec Baldwin, of course, Alec Baldwin. Mm-hmm. But originally Alec Baldwin was meant to be Ricky Roma. But he said, I don't have time for it. I don't want to do it now. And then, like, several years later, he said, you know what? Out of the 25 scripts I've read recently, this one's the best. And that's when they wrote the role for him. And yeah, this just, it seemed to be one of those serendipitous moments where all of these actors and all of these people finally said, yes, we'll do the film. And it got made.
It's lightning in a bottle.
Al Pacino. Basically, he did Dick Tracy 2 years before this.
Oh, fuck no.
I mean, Pacino's career.
And funnily enough, guys, there's still a Madonna connection here.
Yeah, because
Madonna was in the soundtrack, and James Foley did a bunch of fucking videos. He was a video clip director before this. This is, I think, his first or second feature.
It's his third feature.
Really?
he had done it's his fourth feature. He had done Out Close Range, which is a big Madonna.
Christopher Walken and Sean Penn. That's great, and great movie.
Big Madonna connection there. Then he did Who's That Girl, where he directed Madonna, which we all try to forget.
And he did
a fantastic Jason Patrick film noir called After Dark, My Sweet.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either.
Dig it up. It's really, really good. Jason Patrick, Rachel Ward, and Bruce Dern.
Oh, wow. Okay. You sold
Bruce
it.
Dern. Sold. Sounds like David Joshua Smith is going to be on an episode in the future.
Can somebody put David Joshua Smith on the board, please?
Yes, After Dark, My Sweet, 1990. David Joshua Smith.
You're getting a Cadillac, dude.
$6,000.
Second price?
At least walking away with steak knives.
Yeah, steak knives.
Did anyone else actually feel like the steak knives were more useful than a Cadillac
absolutely.
For a second? Like, absolutely. You know what? Yeah, I could do that.
Oh, by the way, to stay on the car, here's a word from our sponsors. Hello, this is Arnold. I drive a BMW. What drives you? Yes, yes, we make cars for the Nazis between 1941 and 1945. But that was a long time ago.
All right. I was going to say the previous one. All right, you can clip
this
laughter.
I'm not going to do it again. There's another head.
No, I just want to say the previous one started turning into John Lovitz.
Hello!
BMW!
Hi! About my problems with a BMW! That's a lie! Okay, well, there's a...
Well, at least it's not a Tesla.
Or should I do like John Lovitz from Happiness, man? John Lovitz from Happiness.
Oh, yes.
Champagne and your shit!
Oh, fuck you.
You know, Michelle wants to do Happiness with us.
That's
Michelle
Stang
from the group.
Yeah.
And I think we should. I love that movie, man. What happened to Todd Solondz, dude?
Yeah, I think we should do a season of his because he wrecked my mind growing up. Like, every film of his wrecked my mind.
It's the type of movie making where you have to shower profusely before and after watching one of those movies. It's hardcore, but it's funny. It's funny as hell.
I have written personal essays on Happiness. That's how much I
love personal essays.
Yeah, personal essays. Which
sounds
mate. I would sit down with my friends and like get really high and just start reading them like poetry.
Like, you're like some kind of perverted Frank Castle. Is that what's going on here?
And the song in Happiness, what does it really mean? Well, give me four more pages.
Mate, have you got this note still?
No, I don't. I can rewrite them, though. I can rewrite them.
Were you recording like a fucking Agent Cooper? Was it written?
Give me a week in Sydney to find some really good shit, and then I can rewrite them.
I can give you a contact in Sydney to find some really good shit if you want.
Nice.
More than one. Anyway.
Right. Not that we condone drug use.
No.
Nobody said anything about drugs, mate. Holy shit. We're going to jail because of you, Steve. We're going to jail. Anyway. Okay. Sorry, David. Sorry. I'm sorry, David Joshua Smith.
David Joshua Smith. We apologize, David Schwartz.
Sir. Sir David Joshua
Sir
Smith.
David does.
Okay. Sir Dave. All right, okay. So, hey, put the coffee down. Coffee's for closers. Okay.
Hey.
I'll drink to that.
Put me on the board. Put me on the board. Okay. Do you want to talk about, because I've got factoids. I've done research for this. I've gone places where I would never wander. Okay. Umba wandered into the dark sides of the internet, finding information about Alec Baldwin's watch. Do you want to know?
You want to go that deep? Sure. Go on, man. Screen dive that one.
Okay, so factoid: the Rolex that costs more of Ed Harris' car. There you go. By the way, sorry. Before we start on this, the BMW sponsored by Arnold earlier. That model is a BMW. Thank you, IMCDB, Internet Movie Car Database. Holy shit, I said it right, man. I spelled it right.
Yeah, you did.
Dave, you know about this, right? You know it's a thing. You can go online. There's the IMCDB, which is the Internet Movie Car Database, and it's got all cars from all movies.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, well, man. Yes. I just ruined your life. That's it.
Yep.
That's 6 hours gone forever. At least six hours. So the BMW is a BMW 850i. It's an 850i produced in 1991. Yeah, that's Alec Baldwin's car. That's the red car that we see at the beginning of the movie, right?
Yeah.
But the Rolex. Oh, the Rolex. That Rolex is a 18 karat gold day date. Series 118238. It was labeled as the president's watch. And in 1966, the most notable president to make that watch famous was President Johnson. But here's something Ricky's going to love this to no end. This watch, before smartwatches, a smartwatch was not a thing, but a power watch was. And it was donned by Tony Soprano.
All the way through the Sopranos. I love that.
It's the same watch.
It's the same watch.
Yes. And it was
fisting action.
That the watch that you see in Glengarry Glen Ross was not an original day date, was a replica made by prop master Robert Griffin. And man, for anyone that really has time to waste after they spend 6 hours on IMCDB, they can go and take a look at the career, the very prolific career of the prop master. The guy that made that, like to rep.
Can you go on INWDB?
Maybe. Remember when I told you I would kill you last, Dave? I lied. But anyway, Robert Griffin, that's the name of the prop master that made a replica Rolex just for this. And that very prop was sold for half the cost of the original. The original watch to this day, if you want to buy a day date of that series from that period, I think it was produced between, no, I think, I'm reading my notes. Oh, I believe, no. It was in 1988 and 2000, that particular series, the one that was worn by a lot of people in the movies. That's an endless list, man. So this was a statement watch, particularly that particular type, like gold or with champagne dial. That was the one that was donned by presidents, by movie stars, and by actors in roles. So Tony Soprano and Alec Baldwin, Blake, a.k.a. Blake or whatever he's called in this. I think it's Blake. Are just two examples, but it was a statement watch. The original prop from Glengarry Glen Ross sold in London in 2023 for $8,000. So,
not bad for a knockoff.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Well, should I go another spot for Rolex by Arnold?
That's a screen dive, yeah.
You know, you can just go to Chinatown and pick one up.
And here's another word from our sponsors. It's Arnold. Don't be a quiet boy. Buy a Rolex. That's it, then.
Please send us a Rolex while you're at it. Yeah. Just one. We'll split the proceedings.
You know what? I'm going to Egypt to Sharm, and that is the best place to buy AAA replicas. AAA. I'm going to buy one. Why am I telling you this?
Oh, fuck. Why are you telling me
this? I'll tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to buy a replica watch, like a really good one, okay? Because there's levels, all right?
And then you're going to get murdered in London.
No, and I'll send it. And I'll send it to Ricky, to Australia, all right? Which means it's going to be stopped at custom and I'll get arrested, but whatever the fuck. And I'll put a note going, greetings from Austria. This is Arnold. Don't be a quiet boy.
You do that. I fully support that. Could you throw a board game in there as well? Can I pick one? Just let me pick.
You know, you're an asshole. One, it's the thought that counts, you know? Yeah. Nobody said anything about, for our listeners, I tried to set up a mood here. So there's like one of those really dodgy fireplaces.
Yeah, 4K I
fireplaces
was going to ask about that.
It's fucking cold in here, right? The warmth of our friendship is not enough. I'm trying to warm it up, all right?
London right now is pretty cold.
Well, yeah. New York. What's the temperature in New York right now? Do it like David Lynch, Dave.
I can't. It is currently dark and about 45 degrees I can't do it, David Lynch.
No, that's amazing!
Where are you going? You're doing it.
That was pretty damn good.
Come on.
Put him on the board.
45 degrees.
You sound like Gilbert Gottfried.
Let me just tell you, right here, in this side of the world, it is 29 degrees Celsius.
I just want to say, have a beautiful day.
That's beautiful, man. That's beautiful. Hey, Dave.
Chef's kiss.
Yeah. No, to the sky. Chef's kiss to the sky. We should do it collectively. I want, like, can we sing four kisses to the sky for Dave? One, two, three. Fucking dude, this is dog shit, all right? It's not even the lag. All right, let's sync up, please. Like our menstrual cycles.
Should we do it off our Rolexes?
Huh? Okay. I'm more concerned with the taste. I just tasted off my own fingers because I don't know what I touched earlier.
Too much.
You wish, Steve.
Are we actually talking about this film?
Yeah, we should. We should go back to it. Oh, by the way, this is like a 90-minute affair, okay?
It was great.
Is there a movie called 90-minute affair? Can somebody check this out?
96 minutes?
Is it a movie called 96 minutes affair?
Wasn't the movie called 96 minutes? Or there was like
Alpha No. It needs to be like 90-minute affair. There's got to be someone do the
Lighthouse affair, Trapped by the Storm. It's a short read.
Is that porn? What is that?
It's smut of the highest caliber for wives.
Fan house in the lighthouse.
Yeah. Kate Bosworth film called 90 Minutes in Heaven.
That's it.
That's getting closer.
The board.
That's getting closer. But it looks like David's our closer for this one.
He is definitely the closer. He's getting that Cadillac.
You get all the coffee.
Until fucking Steve Burt's in going, what check? Hey,
no,
does
this
anyone
is where David
here...
tells us... this is where Steve tells us about a gun that I didn't notice.
Oh my God, dude.
We didn't notice any guns. Don't worry.
Oh, okay.
We're all good, but there was no guns.
So what I found very interesting about this film was actually looking at the play. And Dave, you've read the play as well. Can you tell us how the movie changes the order of what actually appears in the play and some of the extra bits?
It's been a while since I've read the play, but I can tell you the Alec Baldwin character does not exist in the play. Although, from what I understand, when it's performed on stage, it's now in there.
What I found really interesting when I reread the play, I read the play probably about 6 years ago, and I re-looked at the play quickly today through many devices on the internet that were completely legal. But the funny thing is that it actually starts with the conversation between the Jack Lemmon and Kevin Spacey character that appears about 25 minutes into the film. The part where they're talking about the leads. And they're talking about how dog shit the leads are and how crap the leads are. And that actually is the start of the play. The start of the play is the Jack Lemmon character, Levine's character.
The machine.
Begging for something that would actually give him a sale.
Mm. You know, they keep calling him the machine in this. And for a second, where I was watching the movie, I was like, what about Bert Kreischer taking this role? Like, his shirt off. The leads are shit. Oh, man.
David Mamet based his original play on
12 Angry Men?
No, on his own experience while working a real estate agent.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, and basically, he was a struggling playwright in the 1970s, which... That was a long time ago. Shit.
Good observation, man.
But I'm just remembering, but I'm born in the 1970s, and this guy was working in
that time period.
Yeah.
Boiler room.
Fuck, hey, 12 Angry Men is a dozen, and this is six of them. So it's half a dozen, and it's a good analogy, and it's a good parallel, because it's fish in a barrel. It's the same narrative kind of premise. From a structural point, when you look at it, you know, it's a boiler room kind of, you know, it's a what's it called when you write characters that are stuck together in a particular, what's it called, Dave?
I don't know, I'm blanking now.
What are you doing?
I'm blanking.
Blanking.
No, but
stop.
It's a bottle. It's a bottle set.
It's a fish in a barrel. We can describe it as that, right? Yeah. There you go.
Shall we talk about some of the individual characters? We've talked a bit about Blake. Blake kind of comes in and just sets the bomb. We've talked about Shelley.
Stay on Blake for a second. Does Blake's character remind you of someone?
I don't know. The brass balls kind of like took
someone
my
famous?
Attention. Like Baldwin.
What, like Baldwin? someone who's a president right now that is in real estate.
We're not gonna get political.
And the thing is, when I thought about it, I thought, wait a second, didn't he spend 10 years playing Trump on SNL after this?
Yeah.
So that's, I kept thinking about it. I kept thinking of his character in So it's, I don't know why he went one trick pony after this, because if you think about it, in 30 Rock as well, he was like a master salesman. Yeah. Okay, you said we were going to go political.
What was the
you're
gun on the
Ilaria,
set
dude.
Of that
you're
film, Steve?
Okay.
I knew you were going to mention a gun. What was the, oh, look, Amazon package behind you. Your fire's turned into an Amazon package.
Dave, we're talking about
distraction.
Amazon package.
You know what we're talking about, Dave? We're talking about the Rust incident. Of course,
Yeah,
there's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. We shouldn't make jokes about it. It's awful.
Yeah,
it's awful.
It is awful.
Yeah.
But they even he even takes the mic, or he keeps being brought onto SNL to take the mic out of the fact that he's always played. He keeps playing some nondescript conservative. Politician. He always gets brought onto SNL to do the same thing over and over again. Mm. So he's been typecast since this film. And to be honest, I cannot think of another film apart from Beetlejuice.
You know what we should do, man? We know what we should do.
Yeah.
We should do The Shadow at some point.
Oh my God. The Shadow.
It's been a while.
You know, there's a reprint of that in black and white.
Is there?
That's cool. Like
that sounds amazing.
Yeah. So, because the original movie was supposed to be seen as a black and white movie.
Yeah, you know, after Mad Max Fury Road, I think that's the one that exposed, the chrome, whatever. You know what I always did? Because I tried this way before. Just take the fucking color out of your... I know that we have a Daily Colorist here. Wait a sec.
Even before Mad Max, I mean, The Mist, Darren Bond.
Yeah, didn't you do that yourself? Yeah. You didn't have to... Frank Darabont releases, I can just fucking do it myself, right? Or is it insulting to? Is there? Tell me what's happening here.
No. Because they'll adjust the contrast and they'll rejigger the levels in there so that the black and white pops a little bit more. But I mean it.
And I can't do that on my own set.
It's a version of it.
Okay. All right.
Coming from somebody who grew up with a black and white TV in his bedroom. Yeah.
How long ago was that, mate? Yeah.
But wait, Umba,
black and white, but color televisions came later in Wales. So that's what's going on. Is that what you're saying?
No, it came out about the same time. My first TV was a hand me down from my grandparents.
Are they still around?
No, they sadly passed like 30 years ago.
Okay. You want to talk about it?
No.
Okay.
Because the last time I talked about it was something like that in a podcast, we didn't release it.
Oh, my God. Dude, Dave. There was another Dave. There was another Dave. It was David Rodriguez, which we got to do right by him, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes. Disaster. Dave, this is a shout-out to you, Mr. Rodriguez. We'll do it again. We'll do it again without Steve. We'll do it without Steve.
Thanks.
All right,
whatever. I'd like a chance to...
Yeah, to redeem yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fix that stuff up. What were we talking about? We're talking about other characters. So you wanted to say that, Alanar. Now, this is... I'm ready to debate you on this one. Because I personally, on this watch, I thought that this was a film full of antagonists, no protagonists, nobody I was cheering for, nobody I was supporting. Mm. Everybody was just as awful and on the same level as Alec Baldwin when he walks in and he tells everybody to...
Wait a second, because he's got a point here. So you were saying that I did say that if you would have to find any kind of redeeming qualities on any character here, if you were really, really digging, okay? So let me add to it. In my opinion, my personal opinion, that's what I saw, is Alan Arkin. Because Alan Arkin is at a junction where he audibly... is questioning at his age if he should be in this field at all, if sales for him, you know. I don't see him as a coward. I'll tell you who I see as the coward. It's Ed Harris' character. Dave Moss is real piece of shit.
Oh, yeah.
He's a bully. And not only that, but he's spineless as well. So it's not just brutish. He's just fucking spineless. You need him. You need him in this. Because if you've never seen this movie before, when it comes around to the machine, Mr. Levine, being the culprit. And you know what? From a visual standpoint, the best shot in this movie is the phone call in the phone box.
Absolutely.
It's the reflection of Jack Lemmon's face on Ed Harris' phone. As, you know, it's a turning point in the movie. It's Ed Harris is pulling the trigger on his, you know, half-assed plan of stealing the leads. And you get this reflection of Lemmon just gazing. Because you can see his eyes. If you can see his pupils, if you can see his eyes, he's actively listening to what's happening here. And it's if you blink, you miss it. Because it's, you know. Again, by the way, all the shots we're talking about. And Dave, you work in the field. This movie is beautiful. And like I said earlier.
Oh, it's incredible. And that phone call shot, it's just the lighting alone. I mean, you've got the blue light. You got the blue
it's
light.
Red coming and blue, in. Right? It's
not just that. You got the blue light coming in from the from the street, you've got the red light from the window, and you've got Jack Lemmon as this white center, and it's producing this like broken American dream kind of imagery.
Yeah. There is one of my favorite techniques in this. Okay. We talked about it in The Untouchables. And again, there's DNA shared, like Dave said earlier, David Joshua Smith. It was about split diopters. There is a sequence in The Untouchables when Kevin Costner's character, Elliot Ness, and Sean Connery are talking in the church. And it's a split diopter lens used in that shot. So both of them are in focus, but a different there's distance between
different
them.
Different focal lengths.
Yeah, different focal lengths. And the same thing happens in here. As Jack Lemmon is on the phone and Ed Harris is walking. Oh no, actually it's Link going to the bathroom, I think, or something like that. But it's the same technique. Exactly. And I'm wondering do you remember, I think it was 87, The Untouchables was made?
That's right.
I can't remember. Yeah?
Yeah.
So it's an homage. Because, again, we talked about the cinematography here. Man, it's tight. And you can see that James Foley's direction here was, you know, it's because of his, it's got to be because of his video clip background, right? Even some of the timing of the shots, myself and Steve were spellbounded, man. Like, there's a moment in which it happens twice, but it's reverted. When they are walking into the office late at night, someone's walking, and the train is going past in the background. Do you remember that, Steve? We both audibly gasped, like, holy shit.
It wasn't just a train. It was the complete piece. So you had the red lighting from a car, fluctuating, blue from the trains.
Oh, it's...
And the movement at the same time was absolutely perfect.
What's that painting where... It's a painting from the 50s, I think, where people are in a diner. What's it called?
Yeah, the Edward Hopper...
you go. There's an homage to that as well in this, like 10,000 other things.
What's it called?
Tap, tap, tap. Look for it and then let us know. Yeah, another notch off the board.
Is it called Nighthawks? Does that sound right?
I think that's what it's called. Yeah, you're back on the board. Definitely. You're back on the board, Dave.
I see this as a Greek tragedy. It's everybody, nobody wins in this.
No.
No, nobody wins.
Nobody wins. And I feel like we need to look at the way they've structured it in such a way that they try to make at least one character sympathetic, which is Ricky Roma. And then you can see his right towards the end going to possibly the worst of the bunch.
Dave?
I'm going to jump in and say one person makes the right decision, and that's Bruce Altman's character when Jack Lemmon goes to his house and he throws him out.
Mr. Spaniel.
he's like, oh, you're trying to sell me land? Get out of here.
Yeah.
It's the entire sequence. It's like he's exercising diplomacy as far as he can take it. And then that guy, though, dude, that's a character actor that I remember from absolutely everything. He's in The Sopranos.
Yep.
He's also in Mr. Robot. He's like the initial CEO in Mr. Robot.
Yeah, there's a wave of unpleasantness radiating from him. I don't know what it is. And every time I see him in his performance, it seems that throughout, his voice gets more and more nasally. I don't know what it is. It's just, you could draw a graph, you know? Steve, considering that you're very good at drawing, please draw me a nasal graph whenever you can. Okay. You're not doing that.
Well, he is. He is, because you told him to, and he's a very loyal friend, and he will do what I need him
to comply for more important shit. I don't need a fucking nasal graph. What the fuck? Actually, you know what?
Well, then why did you ask about it?
I don't know.
We cannot deny the writing in this. We've mentioned it before. If it wasn't for this, we wouldn't have Boiler Room. We wouldn't have Tarantino. But if you think about the way there was one scene that I had to nasal graph. There's a nasal graph. Snow chains. There's a back and forth between Ed Harris's character Moss and Alan Arkin's character,
you can't even sell an idea to him.
There's a little bit of
he's a piece of shit, mate. He's a piece of shit. It goes from like being friendly to entrapment with him.
There's a bit of a speech that they have in the car, which we may talk about later because it was not of this era, and we can't really like say it without being cancelled.
We can discuss the scene without saying we agree with the scene.
I am going to mention a line later on in this episode that was in the script but didn't make it to the film for good reasons. But we'll talk about that later on. But what I was going to talk about was the canter between all the speeches and all the characters. And here's a good example. Aronow and Moss are having the conversation about not having the conversation. So Aronow is like, yes, I mean, are you actually talking about this? Or are we just, no, we're just talking about it. We're just speaking about it. As an idea. Yes, we're not actually talking about it. No, we're talking about it and it's that canter where they're not really, the plot isn't moving on.
He's pussyfooting around, dude. Yeah.
But the canter makes you almost tense. It adds that thriller element from start to end.
This is Ed Harris, man. He's a phenomenal actor.
It's not just Ed Harris. I mean, it's also it's Mammoth's dialogue. I mean, it's this musical staccato rhythm.
Guys, you know what we talked about earlier? Because you're getting a ticket from Ricky. Did you see the cast?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you guys tell me what the cast is, or I'll tell you if you don't know.
Yeah, the cast. Like you're talking about the Bill Burr, the Kieran Culkin, the
Christopher Guest.
David. No, not David. The other one. Bob. Bob Odenkirk. There you go.
Okay. Yeah. This is my segue into the thing that I just remembered that I want to tell Dave what we talked about earlier. You know, I mentioned this. The segue is there's more DNA. In my opinion, there's more DNA shared here. And I wonder if you... No, I wonder. I know. Come on, man. It must have been... If there was an actor that I would have picked... And in fact, you have Christopher Guest... Bill Burr and Bob Odenkirk. This is Breaking Bad and
Succession.
Yeah. But also the DNA shared with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Right? Because Dave sent me a message, David Joshua Smith, and. He sent me a message about something. And I went, dude, we just finished the movie. And I just realized something I've never realized before. you know how you have actors from different generations that look up, obviously, to someone they grew up watching. And all of a sudden, if you watch Jack Lemmon's performance in this, you realize that Bryan Cranston, man, Bryan Cranston must have idolized Jack Lemmon, because I kept seeing some of Walter. Whenever Walter's pleading or is trying to explain or trying to, when he's desperate, when he's acting desperation, some of the mannerisms. And I thought, there's no way in hell that they didn't reach out to Cranston, because he's at the right age to play Levine, the machine.
At this time?
It would have been perfect. You know,
for the play. Yeah.
For the play.
Yeah. I'm just going to say this because Umba keeps on bringing up the fact that I destroy a movie because I keep mentioning things. But he mentioned this fact over and over again.
What?
So, about Bryan Cranston. You just couldn't get it out of your head. Bryan Cranston.
The Swedish actor. Yeah. Bryan Cranston. Who are you talking about? Bryan Cranston.
Did I say that
when we're watching the movie?
Yeah, multiple times. Not just once. Not by twice.
I'm sorry, man.
Three times.
Did you find that annoying?
I found it as annoying as I am.
You wait. What? You wait until there's a movie with Bryan Cranston brandishing guns. And then we fucking fight.
Well, there already is.
Bob Odenkirk.
It's Bob Odenkirk, but I'm sure there's one with Bryan Cranston.
Yeah,
as well.
I'm sure we can find one.
David, have you seen, what's the name of that movie? It's like, I'm going to fuck you up, but Bob with the gun.
Oh, yeah, Nobody.
Nobody. They're making a sequel.
Yeah.
I'll watch it, but there's no need, you know.
I'll watch it.
Nobody
versus John Wick.
Yeah, it might be a new thing.
Oh, beach it. Take some coke and beach it.
$6,000 and a Cadillac. Anyway, but
they killed my dog and my family.
Dave, just to let you in on a little thing.
David
about
Joshua Smith for you, okay.
David Joshua Smith, okay. Sir Esquire. What I'm going to let you in a little bit on Umbar is that Umbar gets very, 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 very excited about something, and inevitably it leads to him
fucking clip my wings, man. Don't you clip my fucking wings.
But
and
I just
also, did anybody notice, for our listeners, because I cannot see what we're seeing, this is a talking head kind of deal, the sun is rising in New York, and this podcast started with David Joshua Smith enshrouded in darkness. And now we can see him because the sun is rising. Round of applause for the sun.
Great. It's 7 a.m. in New York. Brilliant. Well done. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, my point is that...
Can we do a battle of the Lynches? Because you said that it's 7 a.m. in New York. Can you say that like David Lynch?
Ricky's gone.
As ejected. All right, that was my plan all along. It's just the three of us. Less crosstalk for me to edit.
For those of us who are here, it's 7 a.m. in New York City, and it's beautiful outside.
Are you going to allow this, Ricky, or what's your rebuttal to this? Are we going to do a battle of the Lynches? A battle of the Daves?
No, we're not going to do a battle of the Lynches. Thank you very much.
All right, whatever, man. I'll take you off the board.
Yeah, take me off the board.
Yeah. Fucking not even the steak knives. You get spoons, dude. You get spoons.
Okay, so you're very, at the moment, you're very obsessed about this new casting of Glengarry Glen Ross and the Broadway that is being released in 2025.
I'm obsessed with a fucking dream cast.
Hold on.
Okay.
When this first got made as a play, it was at the Royal National Theatre in London in 1983, and I looked through the list and I didn't recognize any of the British actors. However, when it went to Broadway, the first casting in 1984 included Robert Prosky, who was, if you remember, Mrs. Doubtfire. He was the bus driver, but he was also in Last Action Hero, Gremlins 2,
who?
Hoffer.
What's
his name? Is Robert Prosky. JT Walsh. JT Walsh was also in the original one. He was in Thief, Christine. He was also in Christine and Broadcast News. In the Kevin Spacey role of John Williamson, it had J.T. Walsh, who you would know him from Tin Man, Good Morning Vietnam, Few Good Men. It also had James Tolkien, who was in Back to the Future as the principal, Masters of the Universe, Dick Tracy, Problem Child 2.
Yeah. Okay.
It also had, there was one more.
Dude, Robert Prosky, mate.
Yes, and then it had, of course, Fat Tony from The Simpsons, Joey Montana, with as Ricky, as Richard.
Amazing.
Roma. So at least two of those cast members are Mammoth regulars with J.T. Yeah. Walsh and Mantegna.
Yeah. Mm. And so you can imagine that even back in 84...
Did Mantegna play Ricky Roma?
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
And even back... And he was actually meant to play him in the movie, but of course...
Dude, J.T. Walsh, this guy's piece of shit 101. He would have played that Harris. Yeah. 100%,
no,
right?
He played Kevin Spacey's character, John Williamson. Yeah, so he would have done better.
That
as
well. You know what? There's a movie that's a hidden gem that we need to do. Brett Rockquest with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
And J.T.
Yeah.
Man, I... David Joshua Smith.
Well, you're talking about Red Rock West?
Yeah, and you excitedly approved.
Oh, yeah. You talked about John Dahl the other day.
Did I?
Yeah, you were talking about Rounder. You did Rounders.
And yes.
John Dahl again.
Yes. I think there's too much chromium in my diet. I'm assuming that would lead to Alzheimer's eventually, and I'm forgetting shit. Yeah.
Now, in 2005, Alan Alda, Jeffrey Tambor, and Liev Schreiber did a Broadway revival. Stacey Keach, Alfred Molini did a BBC Radio 3 revival. Jonathan Pryce came back to a West End revival and played Shelley.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Now, this was the big one. This is the one that I wish I made my way to Broadway for. Al Pacino played Shelley. David Harbour of Stranger Things did John Williamson.
Yeah.
Bobby Cannavale did Richard Roman.
Oh, dude, yeah.
Oh, he's perfect. That would have been so good.
Mate, I adore that guy. He's quite versatile, actually, mate. He's funny. You can see his comedic chops in Louis. Yeah. He can play a phenomenal douchebag in Boardwalk Empire. Okay, calm down, Umber. Calm down.
My point is that this script will survive for decades upon decades upon decades with newer actors, newer people in. It's an awesome.
It is a depiction of the worst aspects that are intrinsic to human nature. If humans are pushed to it, there's ugliness, there's darkness in there. And I mean, once again, from a romantic standpoint, when it comes down to fiction or mythology or anything, literary works from the past. If we look at Greek work, for example, you mentioned that. Yes, you're right. You can draw those parallels to classic works. Mm. Steve did that earlier. I don't see it as much of a Greek tragedy, but more of a satirical pantomime on the darkness. Robert Bloch wrote a lot of characters that are akin to these. And I really like the movie, but I'm going to say this towards the end of this when it comes down to when we get to ratings. If anything, and that's personal, not because if this movie is now a notch down, it's because of how it made me feel. But that's completely personal. Yeah, I know.
Because it's funny you said that, because with the Ricky Roma character, when I first watched this, I thought, wow, what a great salesman. But then listening to that last speech he has to seal the deal, he's just talking out of his ass. Just everything he says is such terrible, like, crap.
Yeah, but it's magic, though, because you need that for the next scene to work. And it is magic.
At this point, he is panicking because he's out of his element.
But I actually mean the last scene before the color palette change of the film, before the midway mark of the film, where Ricky Roma is still talking to Jonathan Pryce and is getting closer and closer to him. But it's the whole bad people go to hell. You know, oh, you want to fuck little girls? So be it. That's absolute moral. Everything he's saying is bullshit. And then he finally ends it with, you ever take a dump made you feel like you slept for 12 hours? Hell, have you ever? And it's just like, how are you selling anything with this spewing out of your mouth? But the point is that he is selling silk.
He's speaking in platitudes to somebody who's getting inebriated. All right, any of us can fucking do that. All right, I like to think, if required or as a joke, but here it's pure exploitation. So that's why it's predatory on his part. But it does say something so cliche along the lines of, I've got it in my notes. I wrote it down somewhere. Wait a second, let me find it. Our life is looking back, is looking forward, or looking back. That's it. That's our life. That's like, it means nothing. It means nothing.
Yeah.
But the guy goes, oh, yeah. That's it. He's got him. He's because the guy is drinking away his fucking troubles. He's akin to Niles in Frasier. Okay. That's the dynamic that this guy has with a partner that we never met. Like, we never meet Niles Maris in Frasier. Sorry, this was my chance to throw some Frasier in there.
Yeah.
Another show that is very, very dialogue rich, by the way, that I adore, but that's a different story. But it is that kind of eunuch kind of relationship, right? He's emasculated. Mm. And it comes up. Man, Jonathan Pryce does really well. And really obviously, well. This is we need to ask Dave, all right? Because when I watched his performance, I thought, fuck, I turned on to Steven. I'm like, Jonathan Pryce is English, man. I don't hear it. But Dave, you're American. Could you hear it? Could you hear him slip on the accent?
No, I didn't. But I mean, and Price has done,
Brazil. He's a legend.
Brazil's my all-time favorite film. Yeah, so yeah. I mean,
can I just say, there was a time. Is it like a 2 decades period in which great actors just end up at Bond villains and then fade to? Is that a thing? Is that what everybody's relegated to? Is that what's going to happen?
I think what happens is they offer it to Anthony Hopkins, and then they say, okay, then you have to bring in Jonathan Pryce to do the villain.
But isn't that also another platitude? It's like, you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
it's like Ed Harris. Technically, he's a Bond villain if you take Baroque into consideration in its a James Bond movie.
Mate. By this logic, then we're going to get a Michael Caine.
Yeah. he's 90. Well, he got. Now, it was his birthday. 92.
Mr. Bond.
Yes. 92, yeah.
How about we have a look?
What did you say, Dave?
I said he's 92.
Yeah. He's 90. Michael Caine. It was his birthday like 3 days ago.
How did Michael Caine get to 92? How did he fucking get to 92? What's his diet?
Did you not watch Harry Brown? He just shot a lot of teenagers. That's how we got to 92.
Dude, this is beans on toast, Michael Caine, all right? How the fuck do you get to 92? No vitamin D, Michael Caine, all right? We're talking about Michael Caine, like, not into fucking Bruce Wayne, Michael Caine.
You see this gun, lad? You see this gun? Well, if you're looking down the barrel of it...
My name is Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
Oh, my God, Steve, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna. You know what? I'm gonna continue this with we're leading up to the finale of this whole movie. So, one of my favorite quotes, and this is directed solely at Umbar. You stupid fucking cunt. You Williamson. I'm talking to you, shithead. You cost me $6,000. $6,000 on one Cadillac. Don't write. That's right. What are you gonna do about it? What are you gonna do about it? You asshole. You fucking shit. Where did you learn your trade? You stupid fucking cunt, you idiot. Who are you ever going to talk to? Do you work with men? Oh, I'm going to have your job, shithead.
Fuck you.
There are many, many, many. Can I just say, I'm proud of your Italian hands. I'm so proud. Okay. Out of all the dressing downs, because they're all dressing each other down in this. They're all fucking talking down to each other. And that is the one where, as the audience, you are, you fucking piece of shit. Yes, you are with him. You are with Ricky Rowe.
You were totally with him, yeah.
Yeah, he's a villain as well in this, but you are with him in this. Like,
and you know what's funny? The following dressing, because the dressing down doesn't stop there. It just keeps going. And it just doesn't seem to stop. But because he's used the word cunt, twice in that previous speech, when he gets to the final bit where he goes, "You fairy, you company man," it just comes out beautifully.
The true actor in this movie is a detective. Oh,
yeah. That guy eats so much shit in this.
Oh my god. Dude. Was his name Jude?
I've seen the character actor around. He's been
But I mean, like, it's just that face of
hand in hips.
What's next?
Hand in hips, just waiting.
Yeah,
yeah. It's fucking like pager on the belt kind of thing. It's like in khaki pants and green, light green shirt or something, aqua shirt.
I want to tell you, given how everyone speaks in this film, I want to know what's going on in the interrogation room. Oh, like, everybody's so upset.
Night. But yep. If there were cameras, then we would have known where the leads went. There you go.
Because everyone walks out of that room saying, how can you talk to me that way? And it's like, what did they say?
This movie would have lasted 5 minutes with a ring doorbell. That's it.
Yep.
We know who did it. It's done.
We also have the sea, but they're all selling themselves and being salesmen while getting through this.
So multiple times in the script they refer to Patels. They've referred to it the Indian. So there's this constant use of a cultural group in America of they won't buy anything. And I love the line that Ed Harris says, which is something along the lines of they must be lonely or something. They just phone for a conversation because they don't buy anything.
The reveal from Kevin Spacey to Levine is brutal.
Yeah.
Because he's like, this is his moment. He got his fucking confidence back and it's like, and now he does. We established that he would take a bribe, that he would take money, right? Yeah. He would have taken what he requests earlier.
$100.
But he didn't have it. Levine didn't have it.
No.
And by the way, guys, these people are desperate, all of them, because I checked how much Levine made, adjusted for inflation. As another factoid, that's my segue into the useless research I made for this. Right. He takes, after selling the leads, he takes $2,500, doesn't he?
Okay. Yep.
Adjusted for inflation, that's 5.5. He basically he's desperate because his daughter is in the hospital. He hasn't made a sale in a while. All of them are fucking desperate because these people are ready to risk everything for $2,500 that is now $5,000.
Let's talk about why Blake was there. They're going to close down this department. That's what this is. This is like a last dish effort to see who the best two are. They're going to move them to another branch. They're going to move them out.
Like the office.
They're just going to cut it out. Uh-huh. So the whole point of this first scene is basically saying, like, this place is going to die. We're going to take the best. You guys are the worst in the region. This is definitely the worst office in the region. So we're going to take the two best guys, and then everybody else is fired. And that's
Fuck
it.
Fuck you. Hit the bricks. You're fired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's my name? Fuck you. That's my name.
There's a bunch of that. Are we gonna go through them? You want to go through them?
No, because I just wanted to say the controversial stuff. So I touched on Patel, and them constantly referring to the Indian population of whichever part of America they're in as just people who just kind of want to flash, be like, I can afford this. However, in the play, and this did not make it to the film. In the play, the worst line that is written and isn't there anymore is, this is to do with this group of people. Their broads all look like they just got fucked with a dead cat.
Wow. Wow.
I can say that because it's my culture they're talking about.
Is that a thing?
No.
Okay.
You're not allowed to say that, Umbar. I'm allowed to say that. Is that a thing?
David Joshua Smith, is there anything else you would like to bring to this conversation before we get to ratings? So, Dave.
Obviously, this is Mamet's, you know,
magnum opus?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, this is him taking all of his experiences as a salesman, and he grew up with con men, he grew up with grifters. You know, his childhood, was filled with these people, and then he, all poured it all into this. It's incredible.
This takes place in Chicago.
It's supposed to.
Mm.
I mean, certainly the elevated train's a good giveaway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember? And that's a great opening and great closer. That's it. It's very 90s, but it's a great closer of the train just going by. Which, by the way, this moment of rage that are very William Friedkin in this. Like whenever there's like a, from an audiovisual standpoint, that auditory add-on of the train emphasizing rage. Whenever someone gets angry, you can hear that train. I remember that, and I'm talking about William Friedkin because Friedkin does that very well. It's the sounds of the city, you know, the setting. Otherwise, it's not just like a visual presence, but there's an audio punch to it as well. Audio punch. Let me hit you in the ear. That's a better Arnie than the BMW spot.
It was, yeah, actually. Yeah. Okay. Well done.
I can do better.
Can you do John Lovitz now? Do John Lovitz.
Hey, dude, I'm not a monkey, all right? I'm not a circus monkey.
Oh,
here,
now you're not right? a monkey. Great.
I'm not here to perform for you. Dance, monkey, dance. Imagine if there was Arnold Schwarzenegger playing Marty McFly in...
Oh, this is...
Dance McFly. Oh. No, actually, it would be...
It'd be Biff, wouldn't it?
Okay.
Yeah.
It would be Biff. Ratings. It is ratings time. Before we get to ratings... Any of us, would you agree unanimously that we highly, highly recommend for anybody out there that hasn't seen this movie to watch this movie? Can we do that collectively?
Yeah, I would absolutely say that. And more importantly, if you're a scriptwriter or a salesman, buy the DVD / Blu-ray.
And VHS and beta tapes and Laserdisc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please go out there and seek a dying format to watch this. Just stream it. Just do whatever you need to do. Who wants to go first? Fight!
Dun, 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 dun. I know exactly who wants to get a ratings first, and I had them up. We have a one-star rating. We have a one-star rating, and this one-star rating comes to you from IMDb, and if I can find it quick
Where's
enough.
Mrs. Because Spader? I don't know who you are.
Hey, so what can I just say that Apollo Project 685479654 in July 9th, 2023 called this dull and tedious one star. But more importantly, I would like to have a chat with Casablanca. No, it's Casablanca Vic, December 14th, 2021. Also giving it a one-star rating. Not even worth reviewing. I tried 3 times to watch this, and each time I found it worse than before. It's such a lousy movie. It's not worth reviewing. Lousy and lousy and lousy. The leads. Who gives a rat's ass after 4 minutes in? A bland film that worthy of nothing but putting people to sleep on the couch. Thank you, Casablanca Vic. December 14th, 2021.
Casablanca Vic?
Casablanca Vic.
Okay, what's the other username?
The other username was Apollo Project 685479654.
Okay. Yeah. Can I just say, as much as I love this segment, it angers me.
Exactly.
Yeah. It angers all of us. So it's going to be an 8. It's I love this movie. It's well crafted. The script is amazing. The acting is amazing. It's not. It's come down since I watched it in '94.
On what basis?
I think the script now has dated a little bit.
Ooh.
But it's still a good script and of a time. That's it. It's 8 steak knives.
8 steak knives.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
That's not bad. Who's next?
Go, Dave.
I'll give it 8.5 stolen telephones.
Hey.
It's almost a 9, but or a 10, but I mean I feel like the film is there's something still a little stagey about the film that you can't quite escape the fact that it's clearly written for a stage and it just doesn't quite have that and to James Foley's credit it really does an amazing job of making it feel like it's not a you're watching a play, but it doesn't quite do it 100%. And that's the only reason that I think it's a little bit distracting.
It brings an element of farce to it that doesn't belong here. I understand what you're saying.
And I know what Steve's saying with it's aged a little bit, but I mean, this is, you know, everybody's using, you know, payphones here.
This has been the second rewatch of this film that I've seen in the past 10 months. 10 months ago, for some reason, I sat down with Sal, and Sal said, I've never seen Glengarry Glen Ross. So I said, yes, let's watch it. We watched it about 10 months ago. So I watched it quite close together twice. Mm-hmm. And then I rewatched some scenes again today. I can't believe how much I hate every single character in this film, and yet I can't stop watching this film. This, for me, is a 9.2. This is a high, high rated film for me. I can, like I was saying with Rounders the other week, I can jump any point in this film and enjoy myself. I can rewatch it over and over again. It is a staple of all the actors in it. They are all working at 110%, and they are just eating up the scenery and just doing wonders with each other in magical ways that could be described as an orgy. That it's like watching an orgy, a fantastic orgy on screen of amazing characters. I am going
to
give
this this episode.
This is how much I've been having
five
caffeine.
Cups of Caligula, and it's fucking everywhere. It's you, dude. It's part of your personality now, this fucking movie.
I'm giving this 9.2 brass balls out of 10.
Not bad, not bad, not bad. It is my turn now. Right. This used to be a 10 for a long time, and it is still a 10 when it comes down to artistic value, the execution, the source material, the endless and timeless quality. When it comes, it's my appreciation for everything that goes into this, because also Foley was not a giant at the time. It wasn't, okay? And this is like, it's the never mind. It's the appetite for destruction of somebody's work. It's like, it's a peak. It's almost a problem in someone's career when you peak that early. Because, dude, the last two movies this guy has done were the sequels to fucking 50 Shades of Grey. So, you know what I mean? Like, when you peak early, you need to fucking try and defeat the biggest boss in this video game. And it's you. And it's difficult. It's very hard to do. It's very hard to top your own work when you peak early. This is a 9 now. And that's a whole notch down from a 10, simply because if it didn't have the quality I'm about to mention, this would have been an 8 now. Okay? And to lose 2 points on my estimation for something, that means that I felt, that I recoiled in disgust almost. In this instance, there is a charming quality to each one of these characters but one, which is Eddie's character. That's a testament to the actor, actually. Yeah. But at the end of the day, that's how I make a living, okay? I am in sales. I'm a BDM, a business development manager. I deal, but I try to do it honestly, which is what makes me successful, because in the modern world, that works. This is, even if it's fictionalized, I'm telling you, it is not far at all from the truth. There's a lot of people that would actually have no moral quandaries whatsoever about pulling a con on somebody, or the equivalent of that, or lying to get a sale. It is a very common strategy. And that's why these people end up in real estate. That's why they end up, now it's a dead business. But if you remember, there was a decade in which salespeople were involved in a ludicrous business, like selling phone plans, like fucking airtime plans to people. That's a con, okay? It stopped because any commission that would control trading practices, at the end of the day, they had to shut it down. But that happened for a decade and a half. So people that get into that space, like recruiters or whatever, that just after a sale, you take a block, like it's a game of Jenga. You take some of the ethics out, just one piece, another bit, your entire fucking moral compass comes crashing down, and that's you. So this movie really shows that. And the fact that some people still kind of idolize some of the messages out of this movie as like almost like a doctrine. There are videos out, like as I was doing my research, there are videos out there on YouTube. There's like a masterclass in sales. No, it isn't, mate. This is the opposite of what you want to do. But it's a matter of personal perception. And for me, it made me slightly disgusted. And as much as I was, I remained aware of things that I didn't pick up before, which were beautiful, like the way this movie looked. Because like I said earlier, I was entranced by the thick dialogue in this, how punchy it is, how emphatic it is. But from a visual standpoint, particularly with remasters these days, if they're done right, you're really, the color separation between red and blue, and David Joshua Smith, our guest, works in the field. He knows that that level of saturation is really hard to achieve correctly on camera, particularly when you're remastering. There's a prime quality to these colors. They can easily bleed into each other. So to see that separation, it's beautiful. I have a remaster of Suspiria. That's what I kept thinking about. That was done by the original director of photography, and that color separation in a movie that is that colorful, it's an acid trip, it was a wonder. So to see it here, just with two colors as well, it's absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And it's a movie that doesn't get praise for that quality. You know, it's got a golden cast. It's got Titans. Titans, man. There were Titans back then and the Titans now. So it is a 9, and that's huge in my sense. And it's a 9... It's a 9 pink stacks of leads emphasized by a golden ribbon. That's what it is. And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Steve.
This is Ricky.
Dave Guesting.
Bye! Bye!
We out. He came into her apartment. He left the blood stains on the carpet. She ran underneath the table. He could see she was unable. So he ran into the bedroom. She was stuck down. It was her doom. Annie, are you okay? So Annie, are you okay? Are you okay, Annie? Annie, are you okay? So Annie, are you okay? Are you okay, Annie? Annie, are you okay? So Annie, are you okay? Are you okay, Annie? Annie, are you okay? So Annie, are you okay? A smooth criminal. A smooth criminal.